This is your volunteer reader and Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you this Thursday edition of Northland Views here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. It's the 27th of August, and we have these headlines from the WilliamsNews.com website, News of Williams and the Grand Canyon. As Route 66 turns 100, what is it that we're actually celebrating? Relieved, school district gets grant for HVAC improvements at Williams High School. And Coconino County appoints Nemeth acting deputy county manager. That first headline, as Route 66 turns 100, what is it that we're actually celebrating? This is from the 25th of August by Daniel Malowski of Arizona State University. The Conversation. This article is republished from The Conversation under a Creative Commons license. Working in concert, the American Association of State Highway Officials and the Bureau of Public Roads adopted a uniform highway numbering system and corresponding map on November 11, 1926. The numbering system and map replaced the confusing patchwork of highways and trails like the Lincoln Highway or the Old Trails Road with an official network of numbered highways sanctioned by federal and state highway authorities. Since then, a small group of these highways have attained the status of a cultural icon. There's Route 1, which snakes all the way from Maine to Florida. Route 101 is celebrated for its majestic views of the Pacific Ocean, while Route 6 was immortalized in On the Road, Jack Kerouac's classic novel. The most famous, though, was arguably Route 66, nicknamed the Main Street of America and the Mother Road. Yet, as the towns that dot the highway prepare to celebrate its centennial, I found myself wondering what it is exactly that's being celebrated. As an historian of Route 66, I've written about how there are really two versions of this 2,448-mile stretch of pavement. There's the actual highway, which reflected the 20th century expansion of the nation's infrastructure. Then there's the mythic highway, a cultural icon imbued with nostalgia for a specific 20th century idea of romance, adventure, freedom, and the American West. There was almost no 66. As state highway commissioners in the 1920s wrangled over the specifics of the nation's new highway system, they prized highway numbers that ended in zero since they indicated a cross-country route. The thinking went that these routes would get the most traffic and with it the most business. Oklahoma State Highway Commissioner Cyrus Avery had been a big booster for a Chicago to Los Angeles road in order to juice highway traffic through the Midwest. He suggested calling it Route 60, claiming a coveted cross-country number. But commissioners from Kentucky and Virginia objected, noting that Avery's proposed road didn't go from coast to coast. As an alternative, they suggested 62. Avery countered with a number that he thought had a better ring to it, 66. With the numbering controversy settled, the map of America's first highway system was approved. But another 12 years would pass before Route 66 was fully built out, making it the first U.S. highway to be paved end to end. Adventure, redemption, and reinvention. While it took over a decade for the full physical stretch of road to be completed, the making of the Route 66 myth began almost immediately. Construction of the road had barely begun when Avery, John T. Woodruff, and other prominent civic leaders along the highway's path convened in January 1927 to form the U.S. Highway 66 Association to promote travel along the route. The association began advertising Route 66 as the best West Coast travel route and even trademarked a slogan for the road, the Main Street of America. The association also sponsored spectacles like the Transamerica Foot Race to help publicize Route 66. The race, which started on March 4, 1928 in Los Angeles, received widespread media coverage. Reporters breathtakingly described the epic struggles of the racers, coupled with vivid descriptions of the Southwest landscape. The effect was a marriage of Route 66 to ideas of adventure and romance in America's collective subconscious. During the Great Depression and Dust Bowl years, thousands of migrants from the Great Plains and Midwest traveled west along Route 66, hoping to rebuild their lives in California. Author John Steinbeck dubbed Route 66 the Mother Road in The Grapes of Wrath, likening it to an umbilical cord that delivered Okey refugees fleeing the Dust Bowl in the Oklahoma Panhandle to a new life in California. Working for the New Deal-era Farm Security Administration, photographer Dorothea Lange documented the same Okies fictionalized by Steinbeck. Her 1938 photograph, Family on the Road, captured a husband, wife, and their two young children hitchhiking on Route 66 near Weatherford, Oklahoma, after losing their farm. Together, Steinbeck and Lange helped imbue Route 66 with new layers of meaning tied to loss and redemption. Then, after World War II, Route 66 came to mythologize the post-war boom. Bobby Troup's 1946 song, Get Your Kicks on Route 66, first recorded by the Nat King Cole Trio, cast the road as a post-war rite of passage. Millions of Americans went on to take family vacations to the American Southwest via Route 66, staying at roadside mom-and-pop motels, grabbing burgers at neon-lit diners, and posing beside oversized roadside landmarks. Myth versus reality. But the iconic imagery and myths of Route 66 are often at odds with the reality of the road. I've come to see Troop Song as encapsulating the tension between those two versions of Route 66. In 1946, when Nat King Cole recorded Get Your Kicks on Route 66, Cole and his band were unable to get their own kicks on Route 66. That's because few businesses located along Route 66 were willing to serve them. Jim Crow era's copies of The Green Book, a directory of businesses that would accommodate black road trippers, show just how few options there were. It would take passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and subsequent enforcement efforts by the Justice Department for the travel amenities and services along Route 66 to be equally available to all Americans, regardless of their race. Yet by the time the highway's motels, diners, auto repair shops, and gas stations were open to all travelers, Route 66's downturn had already begun. The 1956 Federal Aid Highway Act turbocharged the construction of new, limited-access interstate highways. These new post-war highways prioritized fast travel between major cities and their suburbs, where Americans were flocking to in large numbers. Fast travel, however, came at the expense of small towns, bypassed by the new highways, depriving many Route 66 businesses of the customers they needed to survive. In contrast to older mom-and-pop businesses, national corporate chain motels, restaurants, and gas stations dominated the new interstate highway exits. Rather than risk exposing themselves to Justice Department civil rights scrutiny, they made it known that they welcomed all travelers, further enticing drivers away from older establishments. Now, as Route 66 turns 100, there's a gap between how the road is remembered by some and how it functioned for most. Free and easy travel on the road and getting your kicks were limited to white Americans. Much of Route 66's iconography emerged from early Highway Association marketing efforts aimed at white Americans. Few African American or Latino travelers likely feel the same nostalgia. Today, a lot of Route 66 nostalgia has a back-to-the-1950s vibe that celebrates pre-civil rights America as a purer, simpler, more authentic era. This faux authentic America better reflects the place some Americans today wish they could live in, a less complicated, less diverse land of adventure, romance, and opportunity, rather than the nuanced, complicated America they actually inhabit today. Daniel Milkowski, the author, is an adjunct professor of history at Arizona State University. And that's as Route 66 turns 100, what is it that we're actually celebrating? We have an article by Calvin Shoemaker next. This is from the 25th of August. Relieved, school district gets grant for HVAC improvements at Williams High School. Williams. A major facilities upgrade is coming to Williams High School. Williams Unified School District No. 2 has been approved for a $6.4 million building renewal grant by Arizona Schools Facilities Division to bring much-needed air conditioning to Williams High School. Joe Howe, District Facilities Director, says the grant funding will cover the installation of all new ductwork, heaters, and air conditioning units for the high school, its gymnasium, CTE building, and cafeteria. The welding and auto shops aren't included in the grant, however. Coconino Community College has said it will contribute to improving that facility as part of its voter-approved bond initiative. The SFD funding is huge for the district, as some classrooms can reach well into the 80s during the hottest part of the school year, says Williams High School Principal Dr. Connie Hargis, acting superintendent. "We're just so relieved," Hargis said. "It's been about 2 months of the year solid that the classrooms are just very difficult to be and learn in." Funded by state tax dollars, the project will take 2 years to complete. Best of all, it comes with no required match by the school district. Howe says most of the work will be completed while students are off campus and that materials could start arriving before the end of the calendar year. The two leaders thank the school community for their patience and the SFD, which has also funded other district improvements over the years. And that's relieved. School district gets grant for HVAC improvements at Williams High School. Next, we have Coconino County appoints Namath acting deputy county manager. This is from the 25th of August Flagstaff. Cynthia Namath, Parks and Recreation Director, has been appointed acting deputy county manager following the resignation of Eric Peterson. Cynthia is well suited for this interim leadership role at Coconino County, County Manager Andy Bertelson said. "Her steady, collaborative approach will ensure that we continue to deliver the high-quality services our residents rely on." Namath has served in her role as Parks and Recreation Director for more than 9 years and brings valuable experience, knowledge of our organization, and a strong commitment to the people we serve. She's overseen the acquisition of Gonzales Ranch, Rogers Lake Natural Area, and Matt Ryan Natural Area, added miles and improvements to the trail system, and updated both the Parks and Recreation and Fort Tuthill master plans. The deputy county manager position will be an open, competitive process for both internal and external candidates. The opportunity will be posted in the near future at governmentjobs, one word, governmentjobs.com/careers/Coconino. For more information about employment with Coconino County, visit coconino.az.gov/779/job-seekers. This information was provided by Coconino County for Coconino County appoints Namath acting deputy county manager. You're listening to Northland Views here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Northland Views and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing simply by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, and that's at sunsounds.org, or you can download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app. That's available for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store, or you can get it from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad. And you can always listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. Our next item is from the Associated Press. Federal officials announce water cuts as Colorado River supplies continue to plunge. Federal officials have announced sharp water cuts for the next 2 years for three western states that rely on the imperiled Colorado River. This article is by Dorani Pineda and Wufai Yu from the 25th of August. Federal officials announced sharp water cuts for the next 2 years on Friday for three western states that rely on the imperiled Colorado River. Under the Bureau of Reclamation's plan, California, Nevada, and Arizona will collectively reduce water use by 1.25 million acre-feet annually during that period, with the possibility of larger cuts depending on conditions. Arizona will see the biggest cuts, while states upstream, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico, do not face any for now. Meanwhile, neighboring Mexico will reduce its intake by 250,000 acre feet under a U.S.-Mexico treaty. We've been in this 26-year prolonged drought period, said Andrea Travnicek, the Interior Department's Assistant Secretary for Water and Science. We continue to see a prolonged drought in our future. So continuing to work together as a whole within the basin is going to be extremely important. The current rules governing the use of the river's water are set to expire in October, and the seven states have been unable to reach a consensus on sharing it over the long term. Last winter saw the worst snowpack on record for the Colorado River Basin, adding more stress on farmers, industry, wildlife, and hydropower producers, as well as tens of millions of people who rely on the waterway, including dozens of Native American tribes and in two Mexican states. Years of overuse combined with drought and rising temperatures due to climate change have depleted the country's two largest reservoirs, which are both fed by the Colorado. Lake Mead recently plummeted to its lowest level since it began filling 9 decades ago, and Lake Powell did the same about a week later. Their combined storage is the lowest it's been in nearly 7 decades. Negotiators in Arizona thank California and Nevada for their collaboration on sharing the cuts. For 2027 and 2028, the reductions that are now memorialized here will provide substantial stability for folks, said Tom Bouchotsky, Arizona Department of Water Resources Director. We'll continue to negotiate and figure out how we're going to operate over a longer-term period, which is all we want. Jamie Hamby, California's chief Colorado River negotiator, said the plan brings some badly needed near-term certainty at a moment of extraordinary risk, though he called it a bridge, not a permanent solution. Officials in Nevada applauded their collaboration with Arizona and California and said a seven-state consensus remains their preferred path for the river. In southern Nevada, Kyle Roerink, senior advisor at the conservation group Great Basin Water Network, said efforts to build a new airport and shopping malls and some public land sales have not progressed, reflecting the dire hydrology inked in the federal documents. Further cuts could slow real estate development in Metro Las Vegas, he said. When the Hoover Dam, a symbol of American fortitude and American power, drops and loses its shine, it can be scary, Roerink said. But it can also pose itself as a great opportunity for us to prepare for the next 100 years in a meaningful way. And that's federal officials announce water cuts as Colorado River supplies continue to plunge. Next, we have Cadence Ironside advances to National FFA AgriScience Fair. This is by Calvin Shoemaker from the 25th, Williams. Cadence Ironside is set to become the first Williams Viking to compete in the National FFA AgriScience Fair. Cadence is a national finalist in the animal systems category for high school juniors and seniors after taking first place at the Arizona FFA State Leadership Conference in June. The senior was selected to move on to the National FFA Convention and Expo to be held in Indianapolis on October 21st through the 24th. Cadence's scientific research project looked at how protective equine leg coverings can warm tendons in a horse's leg with potentially degenerative effects. She'll present her research poster at the national convention and be recognized as a finalist. Cadence's involvement in FFA relates directly to her career aspirations of becoming an equine veterinarian. One of the biggest parts of my life right now is being in FFA, Cadence said. I think it's had a big impact on me personally. It's cool seeing how much it's grown. The Williams FFA program was chartered in 2022 and continues to gain momentum. At this year's State Spring Field Day, a Williams FFA jacket crossed the stage of winners for the first time as two Williams teams placed in the top 10 of their career development events. In June, Peyton Moore won the state's Novice Extemporaneous Speaking Contest, and Williams High School principal Dr. Connie Hargis was recognized as the Arizona FFA Administrator of the Year. Williams FFA advisors are Mr. Kevin English and Mrs. Kirsten Ironside, Cadence's mother. She definitely pushes me a lot harder than some of the other kids, which is great, Caden said. I probably wouldn't have done this without having her as an advisor. FFA is a youth leadership development organization that prepares students for careers in agriculture. While farming is a core component, a range of other subjects like public speaking, forestry, and food science offer something for just about any student to explore. I don't think there's really any other youth organization that really has as much leadership skills and helps develop it, Caden said. There's just a lot to it. And that's Cadence Ironside advances to National FFA AgriScience Fair. Our next item from Williams News was from the Arizona Daily Sun from the 20th of August. Contest open to design new Grand Canyon license plate. Grand Canyon Conservancy is conducting a statewide design contest for a new Arizona specialty license plate honoring the Grand Canyon. Artists of any age who are legal residents of Arizona may submit original designs until September 30th. A public voting period will take place in October, but the final design will be selected by a panel of Grand Canyon Conservancy staff. The creator of the winning design will receive a $1,000 cash prize. Once the design is finalized and the specialty plates become available through the state's motor vehicle division, proceeds will benefit Grand Canyon Conservancy, the official nonprofit partner of Grand Canyon National Park. Design submissions must be 100% original work and not AI-generated, and must adhere to the Arizona Department of Transportation license plate design guidelines. More information is available at grandcanyon.org/pages/grand-canyon-plate. And that's contest open to design new Grand Canyon license plate. Our next article is by Calvin Shoemaker, Moonshot to Bring Annual Pitch Competition to Williams. This is from the 25th of August, Williams. A business pitch competition offering mentorship and networking opportunities is coming to Williams next month. Moonshot, a Flagstaff-based economic development nonprofit, is bringing its 7th annual Rural Arizona Pitch Competition to Williams for the very first time on Wednesday, September the 9th. One of 20 competitions held from Yuma to St. John's, the tour stop has no entry fee and will be held at Grand Canyon Railway and Hotel beginning at 9 a.m. Contestants will learn from business development professionals and top three win cash prizes, with first place advancing to the state competition. All participants receive a free Moonshot membership valued at $5,500 annually that includes perks such as opportunities for business networking, access to funding and educational programs thanks to Moonshot's $2.2 million federal grant from the Arizona Commerce Authority. Entrepreneur Kirsten Hathcock, a Season 2 winner of Shark Tank, co-founded the competition with her husband Scott, Moonshot's CEO. She says past pitches have ranged from ideas for the restaurant industry to medicine and rocket science. It's definitely for people who have a startup idea, Hathcock said. Maybe they've kind of thought about something for years and just haven't really taken a first step. But it's also for those who already have existing businesses because we can help them scale. Hathcock says the competition is one way to bring economic development opportunities to underserved parts of Arizona. Most of the support services that entrepreneurs receive are really in Phoenix, Hathcock said. We wanted to really go around and help those that are in rural areas get the same type of support that you could get in a metropolitan area. The event will begin with a pitch worksheet workshop and practice prior to the actual competition. A $1,000 cash prize goes to the winner, who will compete at the state finals on October the 24th in Phoenix, where two $10,000 grand prizes will be awarded for the categories of lifestyle and innovation. A crowd favorite winner will take home $5,000. To learn more or sign up, visit www.moonshotazpitch.com. That's all one word, M-O-O-N-S-H-O-T-A-Z-P-I-T-C-H. moonshotdebring.com/Williams. And that's Moonshot Debring Annual Pitch Competition to Williams. Next, from the Public News Service, Arizona researchers dye Grand Canyon Springs. This is by Mark Moran from the 25th. Hydrologists on the north rim of the Grand Canyon are using hundreds of pounds of fluorescent dye at Roaring Springs to see how park development could potentially affect groundwater downstream. The rivers and streams are the source of drinking water for people and wildlife in the canyon. As scientists are finding out, it's a big undertaking. Roaring Springs, nestled along the Kaibab Trail on the North on the Grand Canyon's north rim, is largely fed by snowmelt. From there, the water funnels into more than 2,000 miles of waterways winding their way through the rest of the canyon. Hannah Shambliss, hydrologist at the Grand Canyon National Park, said scientists are injecting the dye to see which sources of water contribute to bodies of water downstream. That's all to address the park priorities of protecting source areas for drinking water from contamination and understanding how things like climate change and development might affect Grand Canyon groundwater resources, Chambliss outlined. Hydrologists are monitoring over 50 streams below Roaring Springs to see where the dye ends up and how long it takes to get there. The Grand Canyon Conservancy is behind the project and has helped make funding available to access the tools scientists need to conduct the research. Figuring out the right amount of dye to use so it will be detectable but not visible to scientists 2,100 miles downstream is no simple task, and Shambliss noted there's a lot of complicated math involved. We tried to calculate the total flow of all of the springs. We've got X volume of water coming out of these springs, so if we have this total volume of water and we want our goal concentration is this, then this is the mass that we need to inject, Chambliss explained. Scientists use 4 food-grade dyes in the project, which are safe to ingest for animals and people. And that's Arizona researchers dye Grand Canyon Springs. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining me for this Thursday edition of Northland Views and remind you that you can listen to Northland Views and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app from the Apple App Store for your iPad or iPhone or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And you can always access Sun Sounds of Arizona programming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org. Or you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona as it streams on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show.